last Tuesday, 11-year-old Christian Pavone Pineda of Conroe, Texas, went to bed and never woke up. As a snow and ice storm ripped through the state, millions of Texas residents, including the Pineda family, were left without power and running water, forced to survive in freezing temperatures. On Tuesday night, Christian's family bundled together in their mobile home. By Wednesday morning, Christian was unresponsive. According to the Houston Chronicle, Christian's mother said she suspects her 11-year-old son died from hypothermia. He had arrived in Texas from Honduras just 2 years ago. Now the Pineda family has filed a $100 million lawsuit against the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, also known as ERCOT. And the Pineda family is not alone. A handful of other lawsuits claiming the utility was not prepared for the storm have also been filed. Nationally, the Texas power grid stands out because it's the only electric utility in the country that is not federally regulated. The Texas Supreme Court is reviewing whether ERCOT is exempt from this litigation through sovereign immunity, a legal precedent that exempts government bodies from certain legal claims. I'm Tanzina Vega, and breaking down the legal future of the Texas power utility is where we start today on The Takeaway. Dominic Anthony Walsh is a Report for America Corps member reporting on environmental issues for Texas Public Radio. Dominic, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly does ERCOT do in the state of Texas? Do they distribute electricity? Do they just help manage the distribution? Tell us their role.
Right. So the full title is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. For short, people call them ERCOT. And, you know, last week during the press conferences, they were kind of breaking down what their role was, so that, you know, trying to help people understand. They described themselves as the air traffic controller or the traffic cop for the electric grid. They don't own any of the pieces of the grid. They merely just kind of, you know, they try to manage the flow from piece to piece. And so their role in the blackouts was that, you know, on Sunday night, just over a week ago at this point, several power generating units tripped offline, most of them owned by private companies. And as those units tripped offline, ERCOT saw demand for electricity surging. It saw supply dropping, very dangerous for the grid. That could cause a huge crash that would take a long time to repair. So in that instance, ERCOT's role was to tell utility companies in various cities and regions, hey, we need you to do rolling blackouts now. So that's kind of what ERCOT does. It really just manages the flow of electricity. It's not a regulator. It doesn't have enforcement power. It merely just tries to make the grid work well.
So, Dominic, why are they at the center of this lawsuit from the Pineda family and also a handful of other lawsuits that we're starting to hear about?
Yeah, so, I mean, they've been the big name since this all came about because they were the ones who made the call that these rolling outages need to happen. It's a good question as to whether or not they're going to be the only one held responsible in the courts and in the aftermath in terms of legislation. In the lawsuit you mentioned, there's also, I believe, the private utility is included. In some of the other lawsuits, the various private utilities from different regions are included. So it's definitely not going to just be ERCOT, most likely. You have a mix of players in this equation, from the private utilities to the Public Utility Commission, which oversees ERCOT, which actually is a state regulatory agency because ERCOT's actually a 501c4. So you have a
lot
of...
What's a 501c4, Dominic?
So 501c4 is a nonprofit. And basically, ERCOT was made that way by the state of Texas. So it still does certain governmental actions, but it's also kind of a private entity. So that's actually one of the big questions that now faces the Texas Supreme Court from pre-existing litigation, which I'm sure we'll get to in a moment, but kind of this question of, can ERCOT even be sued?
Well, that's really the question. I mean, there's this idea of sovereign immunity, which would make ERCOT immune from these types of lawsuits. And so the Texas Supreme Court is supposed to decide that relatively soon, right?
Yeah, and that decision was going to happen regardless of these outages. This actually goes back to a lawsuit that's been around for a few years at this point. A utility company in, I believe, Dallas called Panda Utility, private company, or rather they're called Panda Power, my bad. And basically what their lawsuit centers around is demand forecast from ERCOT. ERCOT says by this year, we expect to have this much demand. And so Panda Power built a certain number of generators, and then they say they took losses on that because ERCOT's projection was wrong. So it's been working its way through the courts, and it's now before the Texas Supreme Court. And one of the questions that needs to be answered in this particular lawsuit is, you know, can ERCOT be sued? Does it have sovereign immunity? The Texas Supreme Court will continue to meet until June, at which point it'll go into recess. We're expecting a decision before then, but whatever that decision is, will have ripple effects for these other lawsuits. Now, you know, there's always caveats, there's always permutations to kind of these various legal technicalities. So they might still be able to be sued under certain allegations, even if they do have sovereign immunity, but it'll definitely make it much harder. There'll be a much higher bar to meet for those lawsuits to proceed.
Dominic, what do we know about the 11-year-old Christian Pavone Pineda of Conroe, Texas, who died last week because of what his family says was hypothermia and not having power? What do we know about that case so far?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's still very much in the early stages. Like we just mentioned, it's unclear if it'll even be able to proceed, at least against ERCOT. Family is suing for more than $100 million. ERCOT is listed, so is one of the utility companies that did these, you know, blackouts. And one of the issues here is the nature of the blackouts. ERCOT, what they asked the utilities to do is to make them rolling, which, you know, it moves from area to area. People do get power back eventually, even if it's only for 15 minutes every hour or two. But instead, for many Texans, it was very, very persistent. It lasted for hours just because of the kind of extreme catastrophic nature of this particular situation with the number of generators offline. Certain companies couldn't safely bring back areas and rotate them. And so that's one of the issues you're seeing here now is, you know, there's a question. Is ERCOT responsible that these other utility companies couldn't rotate their outages? Or are the utilities responsible that they couldn't rotate the outages? So that's one of the issues. And it's what led a lot of Texans to be in the cold and dark for, you know, hours, if not days, without any, even a minute of power.
Dominic, you've talked to attorneys in Texas about the feasibility of some of these lawsuits. I mean, we understand so far that ERCOT itself is being determined whether or not it can be sued or whether it has sovereign immunity. But beyond that, you mentioned that there are other utilities that are also being sued in these lawsuits. What is the likelihood of any of these lawsuits actually coming to fruition at this point?
The lawyers I spoke with said those private utility companies, and there's a mix in Texas. Here in San Antonio, where I'm at, we have a public utility, a municipally owned utility. But for the unregulated market, which touches, you know, Houston, Dallas, most of Texas, you're in a market where a lot of companies compete for consumers. And in those cases, the lawyers that I've spoken with tend to agree that those private utility companies are probably going to be the last people standing when it comes to these lawsuits and who could be held responsible, because ERCOT might end up receiving sovereign immunity. The other regulatory agencies already have sovereign immunity. It's established. And these power utilities might be the last one standing. But just one more point on the feasibility issue. The Texas Supreme Court is not just a judicial entity. It's also a political entity in that there are elections. Every 2 years, a certain batch of judges on the Supreme Court face elections. So there's a political consideration to be had for these judges in that there have been massive bipartisan calls for ERCOT to be held responsible for this. And, you know, people will remember if the Texas Supreme Court does not hold ERCOT responsible or paves the way for them to not be held responsible by giving them the sovereign immunity. So in addition to the, you know, kind of nitty gritty legal technicalities of the case, there are also political considerations.
And speaking of politics, I mean, what about Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who seems to sort of pop in and out of conversations here?
So he has laid the blame for this squarely at the feet of ERCOT. And like we mentioned earlier, ERCOT described himself as a traffic control cop, a air traffic controller for the electric grid. And they've said, you know, we can't do anything to force someone to weatherize. We can't fine them. We can't penalize them. But the ERCOT is overseen by the Public Utility Commission of Texas, a regulatory agency with a 3-member board appointed by Abbott. And that particular agency actually has power. There's also what's known as the Texas Railroad Commission, which, believe it or not, has nothing to do with railroads. They oversee the natural gas sector. And so one of the big problems we saw was all these, you know, frozen natural gas lines, frozen natural wellheads. And that was responsible for a huge chunk of these outages. So you have these various regulatory agencies that are political in nature. You also have the state legislature, and then you have the governor's office. At the end of the day, some of the people I've spoken with have basically just said, all that ERCOT is just a pawn in this kind of, you know, game when it comes to managing the power grid. The Public Utility Commission, the Railroad Commission, the state legislature, and the governor's office are the ones, in some people's eyes, that should have actually made a change to prevent something like this from happening.
Dominic, finally, we've talked a lot about the entities here, but what about the people in Texas? How are they faring right now? Have they largely gotten power back, and are Texans starting to dig out and return to some type of normalcy right now?
So the majority of the state, fortunately, does have power back. Water is still an issue. There's still a boil and water notice for a lot of Texans. And there are still some, especially cooperatives, that are still digging out of this. Last check, there was a couple thousand people in the Hill Country region of Texas who are part of an electric cooperative, which is just another type of utility. It's different from municipally owned or private. But they were still getting, you know, kind of their power back on and still recovering from this. So for in the worst cases, this has been over a week long in terms of how long this crisis has lasted for people. But fortunately, the weather is back to typical Texas weather. We're in the 70s again. So, you know, not having power right now is, you know, less dire than not having power in 5-degree weather.
Dominic Anthony Walsh is a Report for America Corps member reporting on environmental issues for Texas Public Radio. Dominic, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Nancy. I'm calling from Dallas. We had intermittent power for about 3 or 3.5 days, but never any water problems. I know many people who were not so lucky and had floods and ceilings that fell in and absolutely no water for several days.
In the wake of this month's winter storm, tens of thousands of insurance claims have already been filed by Texans. And because so many different parts of the state were affected by the extreme weather, insurance companies are expecting damage from the storm to be at least as costly as Hurricane Harvey in 2017. Claims from Harvey totaled about $20 billion. Now, the big question is whether insurance companies will cover most of the storm repair cost or whether Texas residents will end up footing the bill. Joining me now is Kyle Arnold, the business reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Kyle, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So what is the biggest type of damage claim that Texans are reporting right now?
Right now, it's burst pipes inside a house. I was one of the people that lost power. Fortunately, I didn't have a burst pipe, but a lot of people had lost power for several days as temperatures dropped into the single digits. And our houses here just aren't equipped to carry that kind of cold and the pipes eventually. And oftentimes it'd be very loud bangs when these pipes would shatter and even put holes in walls.
So we know that there are folks who are homeowners, likely have home insurance, and then there are those folks who are renters. What is the difference in terms of whether or not the renters versus the owners will see some of these issues that they were dealing with repaired at no cost to themselves?
Well, one of the issues is that usually if you're a homeowner and you have a mortgage, that you're required to carry some kind of homeowner's insurance. Only a small majority of people that either paid it off, probably are elderly, don't have a payment, or if you're extremely wealthy and you can probably cover the costs on your own. Renting insurance is not always required. You probably won't be required to pay for the cost of repair, but if you did have water damage, like what happened, that's when you figure out there's a pipe that burst. Often is because water starts spraying into your home. Often people had to leave their home for several days. and or hours at least, and there's a lot of water in their apartment doing a lot of damage. So those are the people that, you know, could really be in trouble, the people that were renting in apartments. And that's where you saw some of those dramatic photos of water dripping from ceilings and some of these icicle chandeliers in homes, or often in apartment buildings.
What has the Biden administration done so far? We know that they declared Texas under a disaster declaration. Does that affect potential insurance claims?
That will help people on the back end after their insurance covers it. Now, he extended that to 108 counties yesterday that were the hardest hit here in Texas. So after all is said and done, after you deal with your insurance company, FEMA should be able to help you out. But until then, and probably for a couple of weeks now at least, you're going to be dealing with your insurance company first and foremost.
Well, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun. Let's talk about what people in Texas should be doing when dealing with their insurance company. Should they be looking out for anything in particular?
Well, one of the struggles right now is just getting your home fixed. If there's a hole in your wall, often you don't have power. You've had to shut it off at the main line. You got to get that problem solved first and immediately. And there's not a lot of plumbers, at least not enough plumbers to go around at the moment. So what you want to do is you want to try to get as many quotes as you can. I know that's kind of old, fatherly wisdom, but get as many quotes if you can get a plumber, and document everything you possibly can with videos. And one of the real struggles is going to be is that often you don't know what the problem is behind the wall and how much damage there has been to your home.
Have insurance companies tried to work with this new reality? I mean, are they doing anything different to make things easier to file claims during the pandemic?
They actually have adapted. You saw this a little bit before the pandemic, but they have moved in a more kind of virtual claims. If you have a burst pipe in your wall or some other kind of damage, you can do a video walkthrough. They've got a lot of insurance adjusters out in the field, but they're also, you know, letting you do that virtually. And if as long as it's not, you know, catastrophic in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, they're likely to have settled the problem that way.
Do we know whether or not, Kyle, insurance companies are going to start to rethink what they underwrite given this new climate change reality? I mean, the snowstorms that hit Texas, the extreme weather that came through. We mentioned Hurricane Harvey earlier. Do we know if they're thinking about rewriting some of what they expect to cover given the change in the weather?
They are definitely thinking about that. I talked to a company that calculates a lot of these catastrophic claims and the total impact on the industry yesterday. You know, you said we've had hurricanes, tornadoes, you know, a freak snowstorm here. It's definitely on their mind. And they've done little things over the last few years, not just because of this, but for all things. Like, you know, they'll prorate the replacement cost on your roof, or there's just little tiny caveats in your insurance policy that, you know, make you either you're required to do things, or maybe there are little things that they're not going to cover in the event of some catastrophic events.
And finally, are there any scams that Texans should be aware of right now that are on your radar as far as, you know, this moment? We know, unfortunately, there are people who might try to take advantage of the moment.
Yeah, it's that flood of contractors we get right now. Somebody comes to your door offering to do cut rate repairs, or, you know, wants a big chunk of money up front. That's what we have to watch out for, because there's kind of a roving band of these guys that come from emergency to emergency.
So just basically make sure you're dealing with someone who is reputable, or how does someone determine that?
Yeah, exactly. You can contact your insurance company or the Better Business Bureau, or look for licensing and bonding documentation. You know, even go on Google for reviews is always helpful.
That's what a lot of folks are going to be dealing with these coming days and week. Kyle Arnold is a business reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Kyle, thanks so much.
I appreciate it.
This is Jeremy, and we live in a neighborhood called Turtle Creek in the center part of Dallas. Everybody around us lost electricity, and I do mean everybody around us lost electricity. And we were very grateful that we did not, but it left us feeling a little guilty that we perhaps didn't do our fair share of rolling blackouts. We did do our best to turn off and use less electricity, but we've heard some pretty heart-wrenching stories from friends and people around us. One particular friend nearly froze to death. It's pretty heart-wrenching, and the damage around town is pretty bad from busted water pipes.
This is Preston near Dallas, Texas. I lost power at my house for many hours and turned off my water at my own home, went up to see my parents, and was there when their fire suppression system apparently froze. They had taken precautions on outdoor faucets and things, but one of the pipes was more exposed than they realized, and the water that came through the light fixture and flooded part of the house would have been definitely a financial strain on me if it had occurred at my own house. I was very fortunate. I have one very small and slow leak that is not as pressing as many other people's, considering how long it stayed below freezing and how long my power remained out. I am very fortunate to not have experienced more damage.
This week, the confirmation hearing for Merrick Garland as U.S. Attorney General is underway. And though he'll have countless legal challenges on his plate, the longtime judge already has made one priority clear.
If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, a heinous attack that sought to disrupt a cornerstone of our democracy, the peaceful transfer of power to a newly elected government.
The Capitol insurrection won't be the first time Garland has had to confront domestic terrorism in his career. In 1995, as an official with the Justice Department, Garland supervised the criminal investigation into the Oklahoma City bombings that killed 168 people, the deadliest domestic terror attack in U.S. history. To discuss that and more, I'm joined by Faiza Patel, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Faiza, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Merrick Garland, many people may remember him when he was former President Barack Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court back in 2016. Remind us of a brief timeline of his experience, of his judicial experience.
Well, you know, when Merrick Garland was nominated to be a justice on the Supreme Court, we were a few months away from the election. And at that time, Republicans controlled the Senate, and they had decided that they would not move forward with Judge Garland's nomination, thereby blocking President Obama from appointing someone to the Supreme Court. And that seat was held over until President Trump was elected. And at that time, Judge Neil Gorsuch was elevated to the Supreme Court instead.
So let's talk a little bit about exactly what Merrick Garland's role was in the Oklahoma City bombing, in prosecuting that, and how that experience will inform his approach as Attorney General, if confirmed.
So, you know, Merrick Garland was deeply involved in prosecuting both Timothy McVeigh for the Oklahoma City bombing and Ted Kaczynski, who is the Unabomber sending letter bombs through the mail, as well as the attack on the Atlanta Olympics. So, you know, he has deep, long experience in prosecuting domestic terrorism, and he has experience doing it under the set of laws that were in place back in the 1990s, which I think is great because he knows that our current legal framework is more than sufficient to actually prosecute domestic terrorism. And when we talk about the attack on the Capitol, in addition to regular criminal laws, there are many particular laws relating to insurrection and sedition, which the Justice Department has indicated that it could well rely on. So he knows he has all the legal tools he needs, and he doesn't need a new domestic terrorism law, which is an idea that's been floated quite recently, both from the Hill, and it's been reported that the new administration is also considering whether such a law is needed.
Faiza, tell us how much the Oklahoma City bombing laid the groundwork for the type of domestic extremism and terrorism we're seeing today.
Well, you know, white supremacist violence has a long history in this country, right? I mean, the Ku Klux Klan, you know, moving on from there, it's a persistent threat. And the thing that really happened during the Trump administration was that these violent movements were given a free pass, as it were. You had an administration that was not only unwilling to crack down on them, but actually refused to disassociate itself from them. So it really gave an opening. And we saw this coming into Charlottesville, coming into the attack on the synagogue. I mean, there was just a series of these attacks. So, you know, you have this long history, which then kind of burst into the open during the Trump administration, and that combined with all of the lies around the election brings us basically to the Capitol attack of 1/6. So it's a persistent problem, and it's a problem that, you know, we really have to double down and deal with it. And one of the things that we've been saying for some time from the civil rights community is, look, we need a serious strategy for how we're going to deal with white supremacist violence. And we need data. The Justice Department doesn't even collect data on white supremacist violence. You know, we get periodic updates, often through Freedom of Information Act, but from the Justice Department about what it calls international terrorism. There's no such information available about domestic terrorism. So it's very difficult to judge exactly what the department has been doing.
Let's talk a little bit about, broadly, how should the Justice Department be thinking about domestic terrorism?
So there is a domestic terrorism bill which was introduced by Representative Adam Schiff in the last Congress, which would basically, you know, classifies a number of acts as domestic terrorism and gives the Attorney General the authority to decide that they constitute domestic terrorism. Now, when you're looking at a nominee like Merrick Garland, you might feel comfortable with a bill like that. But I would draw your attention to the fact that, you know, just last year, under Attorney General Barr, groups like Antifa, which isn't even a group, were being called domestic terrorists. And if a law like that had been in place, then, you know, the Attorney General at the time could have decided to prosecute essentially property damage as domestic terrorism. So it's a very broad law. Another approach that's been proposed has been to copy the international terrorism framework and make it illegal to provide what they call material support to a designated organization. Now, until now, the U.S. has only designated foreign groups as terrorist organizations, never a domestic group. And if it were to designate a domestic group, I think we would run into some serious First Amendment issues. But even beyond that, you know, the designation of a domestic group, like the international designations, is a very political decision, right? So it's something that the executive branch gets to do pretty much on its own. So you could certainly imagine an administration designating groups that it doesn't like. You could imagine them designating environmental groups, for example. We've seen a lot of attacks on environmental groups through a number of state laws already. You could see them designating a group like Black Lives Matter, which, you know, they, in the previous administration, were very focused on finding ways to suppress. So there's a lot of mischief that can be done with either of these domestic terrorism models that have been proposed. And it would really inure to the detriment of communities of color and protesters and really anybody who opposes the government in power.
Also curious how Garland, if confirmed, would reshape the Justice Department, but also some of the work he would have to do to sort of revamp the department, given the intense politicization of the Justice Department under former Attorney General Bill Barr and the Trump administration. How much work would Garland have ahead of him in restoring trust in the department and getting the staff that he wants into the department?
So I think he faces a few challenges. So one obviously is relating to these politically sensitive investigations that are ongoing, including the Durham investigation, which is into the investigation of the Russian election interference, as well as the investigation into President Joe Biden's son Hunter, tax situations with that. So, you know, he'll have to be very sensitive about how he handles that. And you know, during his testimony, I think he suggested that he would be taking a pretty hands-off approach and allowing the line prosecutors to make, or career professionals to make the decisions over there. I think the second challenge that the Attorney General would face is, you know, sort of reassuring minority communities that the Justice Department is on their side, which during the Trump administration, it clearly wasn't. And I think over here, he's fortunate that the team that hopefully will be in place alongside with him includes sort of prominent civil rights attorneys. I mean, he's not in this alone. You know, he will have Vinita Gupta, who was formerly the head of the Leadership Conference, in the number three slot at the Justice Department. She was formerly the head of the Civil Rights Division under the Obama administration, and Kirsten Clark, another civil rights leader heading up the Civil Rights Division. So these are powerful allies for the Attorney General in his effort to get the Justice Department on track. And I guess the third thing that really he will have to deal with is sort of the morale in the Justice Department. And I think, you know, he came across during the confirmation hearing as someone with great integrity and poise. And I'm hopeful that his leadership will be able to assure people working in the Justice Department that the politicization of the Trump era is over.
Faiza Patel is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Faiza, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. 1 year into the coronavirus pandemic, some people who have been infected with the virus say they still feel symptoms ranging from brain fog to fatigue to shortness of breath long after they test negative. These are the so-called long haulers. And for some of these long haulers, it feels like there's no end in sight. Yvonne Heapy is a science teacher from Washington State, and she first got sick in March, but the real trouble didn't start until 5 weeks after she contracted COVID.
I knew something was definitely wrong. My heart started beating rapidly, out of breath, hot sweats, cold sweats, really bad headaches to the point where I couldn't function during the day. My days were probably 2 or 3 hours long, and then I had to go back to bed. And then I started to get brain fog issues and slurred speech issues. So I just sort of let the doctors do the tests. They didn't find anything. It just felt like, oh my gosh, I'm going crazy. I'm going insane. And literally it feels like you're dying slowly. And yet nobody's giving you answers.
As Yvonne searched for medical help, she tried to learn to live with her symptoms.
You're trying to get out of the illness. You're trying to say, okay, I can fight this. I can get over this. And then you start having maybe 1 or 2 good days where maybe you can get out of bed and you can do things and you try to fight through it and you say, okay, I can get it done. I'm going to ignore the pain. But then you collapse. Your heart won't let you go any further. Your breath won't let you go any further. You're repeating things in your mind, activities you can't complete. And you're just, even down to making coffee, you couldn't make coffee because you're just, where did I put the coffee filter? I end up actually going from Washington State to New York State to see a neurologist. I'm hoping that with more experience, a neurologist on the East Coast can help me. And it's that neurologist that says, you know what, you obviously had it. I am seeing hundreds of patients like you and there's nothing we can do. And so that's a big bombshell because now you're at the point where, oh, I do have it. This is as a result of this virus. I've been trying to figure out what's been going on, and now somebody's telling me they can't help me at all. I don't know how to even explain it. It's your whole life just feels like it's gone. So, and then no one can help you. That's a very devastating moment.
With treatment, Yvonne did start to temporarily feel better, and she started teaching again.
I did that until November, when I had a really bad relapse again. So brain fog returned, heart problems started happening again, tachycardia, out of breath. I collapsed 3 times during work because I got dizzy getting up. They found I had severe anemia. They found my liver enzymes were very high.
Yvonne's life now is very different than it was before COVID.
Well, first of all, physically, I can't do the same things. I can't even do half of what I used to be able to do. But mentally, it takes a toll. My mind isn't quite the same as it used to. So I've developed skills to compensate. I do a lot more note-taking. I do a lot more sticky notes everywhere to remind myself. And I really feel like parts of my memory have just faded. That's a little bit traumatic. Then it's just not being able to function. I'm normally a very active person, having worked 2 jobs. I have 3 kids, always very active. And all of a sudden, I'm down to counting the hours and sort of counting the amount of time and energy I use during the day. It's like sort of like counting calories, but now I'm counting energy units instead. And if I go over, like this interview right now, I'm already feeling pain in my chest. So after our interview, I'll probably go to bed for the rest of the day.
Her condition has improved somewhat since then, but she still feels the effects of long-term COVID on a daily basis.
I think the one thing I'm seeing as I turn the corner with my last relapse in November, a lot of us started to fall into depression. Your life is gone. It's no longer the same. And you're physically not able to manage a regular life like you did. And there's no answers to that. So how do you do that every day and not get depressed and say, will I ever get my life back? Will I die young? Will some of this come back next year or the year after and do more harm again to my body? The fallout is all this depression for a lot of us not getting the support we need. And the other aspect is our own relatives. Some of us have relatives who don't believe that we're going through this. It's very hard for us, I think. That takes its mental toll.
Dr. Christian Sandrock is a physician who specializes in infectious diseases and pulmonary and critical care at the University of California, Davis in Sacramento. Dr. Sandrock, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
From a medical perspective, doctor, how do you diagnose the long haulers?
Well, this post-acute COVID syndrome, as we like to call it, or long haulers, is tough to diagnose because, as you sort of noticed in this segment, many of the tests can actually be normal. And it's this mixture of symptoms, which are really what we call nonspecific, you know, fatigue, brain fog, lethargy. But in general, you know, having acute COVID, having an infection, and then having these cluster symptoms at some point afterwards, usually about 60 days or longer, gives you the first clue based on symptoms that they might have, you know, this long haul COVID. Secondarily, there are a number of tests that we can do. For example, pulmonary function testing, which are, you know, tests on your lungs that we do to see, you know, your lung capacity, how well oxygen moves across your lungs. Some cardiac imaging that we can do as well, MRIs of your brain. Certain things where we might see some deficits we shouldn't otherwise see in a younger, healthy person, even after an infection. And that can just be some added help for the diagnosis. But we still don't have a great sense of what is the classic diagnostic criteria. And, you know, the scientific community is still forming that together now.
Dr. Sandrock, there is some data on this. So far, what we know is that about a third of the people who were never hospitalized for COVID still say they have long-term symptoms. At about 2/3 of people who were hospitalized for COVID also say they have long-term symptoms. Can you draw any conclusions from this preliminary data?
Well, the data that shows 1/3 just came out from Washington State in a letter in JAMA just last week, which, you know, even less than a week ago, which was really the first data looking at people who were never hospitalized. And the reason that becomes important is we know if you come into the hospital with an acute illness, say it was a trauma, say you have influenza, severe sepsis, any of these severe infections, and you have a prolonged hospital stay in the ICU, you're on life support, you get sedation, you're put in a coma. We already know that that's going to lead to many of the symptoms you heard here from this this patient from Washington State. So we know that fatigue, depression, lethargy, decreased exercise tolerance, all of these things will sort of come with that hospital illness. So it becomes important to say, what is that severe hospitalization and what's actually COVID and related to this post-COVID syndrome? So that's why these studies have become important, that we're now really seeing that people who never were in the hospital, never saw a doctor, are having symptoms now, you know, a year out, 6 months out, even, you know, 3 months out. And I think that becomes really important, that this is a real syndrome. And one of the first steps we like to focus on is validation in our patients that, no, you're not crazy and you have a cluster of symptoms which are really nonspecific, but this is all part of what COVID has done to your body.
We just heard from someone who says that this is Yvonne, who said described her symptoms pretty clearly. Dr. Sanrock, would you say that Yvonne's symptoms are typical for what's known as acute COVID post syndrome? I may not have gotten the medical definition there accurate.
Not a problem. We in the, you know, this community, in the scientific community, are trying to even diagnose it. And, you know, we just like to say post-COVID because it sort of implies you're not infectious, which is key. And, you know, she is very classic. So a mixture of, you know, brain fog, some physical findings like shortness of breath, high heart rate, inability to have any stamina and do exercise. And then what, you know, is also important is what you talked about at the end, this kind of reactive depression where you really have depression from the infection, but also depression from your, you know, post-acute COVID syndrome where you're really, your life is not the same and you can't do what you've done before. And that includes loss of taste and smell, which is really key.
Dr. Sanrock, we heard Yvonne at the very top of the previous segment talking about not just her symptoms as a COVID long hauler, but also her struggle going to different doctors and trying to identify what this thing is that she was feeling. And you mentioned validating patients earlier so that they don't feel like they're crazy or that they're, that the doctors don't believe them. How important is that for doctors to do?
I think, you know, with any disease, honestly, validation is important. And, you know, we get trained in our medical career to really focus on, okay, you have an abnormal test result or an abnormal finding on physical exam, and that sort of correlates with a disease state. And it's hard in this post-COVID phase to sometimes find some abnormalities, but we are seeing clearly enough people, and we know from other illnesses, that these kind of non-specific symptoms can persist. And I think it really is important to let people know they're not crazy. Life is moving fast. They can't move fast for a whole host of other reasons. And we need to adjust life so that they can slowly recover. And, you know, that really is the first process, because to not be validated really, you know, and we hear about a lot of depression, anxiety, and the psychological effects of chronic disease. We know that, you know, not knowing what your illness is and not being validated really leads to worse outcomes in those areas down the line. And that's the first thing and a simple thing that we can prevent. You know, this is something our patients are feeling. I can't contradict what they're feeling. And I think it's important for a lot of doctors to start with that and then really look at ways to really help patients out, whether they have abnormal test results we can really focus specific treatments on, or whether we have to look at lifestyle changes.
Doctor, is this, you mentioned chronic, other chronic illnesses, and I'm wondering if what we're seeing here with COVID long haulers in particular indicates that COVID-19 itself could become similar to a chronic illness, like I'm thinking things like autoimmune issues like lupus or other fibromyalgia or other things that are difficult for people to see, but that are still affecting patients.
Yeah, I think that's that obviously remains to be seen as we're sort of early in this process. But I think you raise a really good point, is the chronicity of this and whether it parallels other, you know, post infection syndromes we see, such as chronic fatigue or other autoimmune diseases, such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, or even fibromyalgia. And a lot of the symptoms we're seeing really overlap very closely. So that's one of the areas where we can say, okay, what have we done with fibromyalgia? What have we done with chronic fatigue in the past? And can some of those treatments help here? There are some unique features to this post-acute COVID phase that are very unique to COVID. So I want to be distinctive with that. And it's not exactly the same as those other disease states, but there are some parallels, which I think, you know, could turn long-term, or they may, this may be a distinct process from those, but have enough similarities that we can overlap treatments.
Does the age of the person who had COVID-19 matter when it comes to who is more likely or less likely to experience long-term effects from COVID-19?
You know, that's an interesting question. And we are seeing sort of two groups of risks, and the risk for developing a post-acute COVID syndrome are really largely unknown. There are a few studies out there looking at the risks. And obviously, if you came in and had a few risks for more severe disease, diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, as an example, we know you're going to have a more severe COVID infection, and that more severe infection might lead to increased likelihood of a post-acute COVID syndrome. But there are a group of patients who are generally younger that are, and again, don't have any risks and are actually having post-acute COVID syndrome. So there was a study out of the UK that, particularly when we looked at psychological and neurologic effects of COVID, they were much higher in the age groups between about 20 and 50 as they were in the age groups of 60, 70, and 80. So there may be some trends, but I think we have a lot more research to do. The NIH is putting a call out funding in this area. So hopefully in the next year or two, we'll have a lot more research. Not very comforting for our patients to hear where it's going to be some time before we have data. But I think it's really important to realize that this is not age specific, and we can't just think it's older patients who've had severe COVID. It's also young patients who are really otherwise healthy. The youngest patient I saw a patient last week who was 19. It's pretty hard to see someone who's debilitated at 19 and otherwise was healthy.
Doctor, two final questions for you as we round out the segment here. Are there any medical treatments that you see that are promising? And finally, are those folks who are suffering from COVID long term, are they able to apply for things like disability in the meantime?
Oh, two great questions. So treatment is sort of a big black box right now. And I think the only thing I've seen that's worked with my patients, and again, I don't have scientific data, is that number one, it's the treatment is individualized. And number two, it involves lifestyle changes. Now, there may be specific treatment. So for example, the first patient at the top of the segment here who had chest pain and shortness of breath, if we found she had some abnormalities, an example, had some clotting in her lungs, we could put her on a blood thinner. Those are specific treatments based on specific issues we have. Maybe her oxygen level's low, we give her oxygen. Of course, we're going to do that. But for the global syndrome, really lifestyle changes are the only things I've seen that have helped. So again, if you need to take a nap, we take a nap. If you need to slow down your life a little bit, if there needs to be some yoga, meditation, nutrition changes, really pacing your life as it moves fast and you now move slower in this post-illness phase, we need to do so. But that raises the second question you have, which is if you're working full-time, how do you then manage your full-time job when you, after 2 hours, you have to take a nap? And how do you slow your day down when you have a fast-paced job? And we see that with a lot of my coworkers in healthcare who have a post-acute COVID syndrome. Healthcare is fast-paced. We're moving in the ICU constantly, and they can't quite keep up. And how do we then support them through that phase? And yes, people are able to apply for disability. But again, if you have a concrete test abnormality, it's much easier than if you have a group of symptoms that are really less specific. And that's one of the challenges we have as well.
Dr. Sanrock, one last question for you. You mentioned healthcare workers also bearing the brunt of this. How are you coping in this moment? We know that healthcare workers have also dealt with a lot.
Yeah, that's also a great question. I guess I'm still alive and I'm coping okay, but it has been a very long year. And I can easily say with many of my colleagues as well that this has been the worst year we've had. And it's extremely exhausting to not only manage the pandemic in the acute phase, but to also deal with this aftermath, particularly with both our colleagues and with our patients. So it's been a challenging year at best, but we're holding up okay. And that's sort of what we trained for, right? This is our job. This is what we signed up for. We didn't plan to do this every day, but this is unfortunately what we trained for, and we're proud to do it.
Well, we appreciate you and your colleagues out there doing this very difficult and important work. Dr. Christian Sanrock is an infectious diseases and pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of California, Davis Health in Sacramento. Dr. Sanrock, thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Christian Georgiou from South San Francisco. I had lingering symptoms from COVID for about a month after I was cleared. Mainly, I was out of breath. I got tired really quick, and I had like stabbing needle-like pains inside my lungs on and off. And I also had some strange visual phenomena and sent me to get an eye exam. I'm pretty much back to normal now, I guess, but it was pretty stressful for about a month or so.
My name is Philip Gutman. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. I contracted COVID on a work trip to New York City last March. My symptoms progressed to severe COVID, and I was eventually intubated and placed on a ventilator for 23 days. I was in the hospital for over 2 months before I was released. I felt very lucky to have survived, and I was told that I would make a full recovery, but it's come with a lot along the way, and it hasn't been easy, and there are a lot of things that still remain uncertain. The first couple months of being home from the hospital, I was in rough shape. So rough, in fact, that I had to go and stay with a dear friend to help look after me day to day, stuff that came up at night. A lot of the stuff that initially came up for me was severe leg cramps, severe headaches and earaches, anxiety, PTSD, and getting fatigued and exhausted easily and having to sleep and lay down.
This is Jenny from Lakeland, Florida. I had COVID really early, last April, actually, and it took me about 21 days to get back to work. It's almost a year later, and I'm still experiencing after effects. I have some days where my chest feels really tight, congestion, but sometimes it gets so bad that I actually bought an over-the-counter inhaler. I get short of breath pretty easily, and I'm still just tired all the time.
And that's our show for today, everyone, and we really appreciate you tuning in. But before I leave you today, I want to highlight one piece of audio that made me pause and think. Last night, President Biden marked a grim milestone in American history. More than 500,000 Americans have died from COVID-19 since the pandemic began. The president addressed the nation, speaking directly to friends and families who've been left behind in an attempt to offer a message of healing and hope to a divided country.
We'll remember each person we've lost, the lives they lived, the loved ones they left behind. We will get through this, I promise you. But my heart aches for you, those of you who are going through it right now. May God bless you all, particularly those who've lost someone.
If you would like to share a remembrance of someone you've lost to COVID-19, record a voice memo on your phone and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, that's 877-869-8253, and leave your memories there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.